It is Monday, the 4th of July, here in Washington, America's Independence Day, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Just ahead, we ask what can be done to stop a wave of Islamic State organized or inspired terror attacks, with Baghdad the latest target. We'll look at the legacy of the late Holocaust survivor and Nobel laureate Elie Wiesel. A NASA space probe prepares for a first-of-its-kind rendezvous with Jupiter, and a U.S. movie critic tells us which films to watch this holiday season.
4th of July is a big platform for some large films. One that I have been looking forward to, because I've been a fan my whole life, is The Legend of Tarzan.
It's all ahead on International Edition. Well, it was one of the worst bomb attacks in Iraq in the past decade, a truck bomb that struck the capital's mainly Shiite Qarrata district early Sunday. Western news agencies are quoting Iraqi officials as saying the death toll has risen to at least 200, with many more wounded. The Sunni extremist Islamic State group claimed responsibility. Jonathan Shanzer is the vice president for research at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies here in Washington. I spoke to him today and asked how he interprets the IS involvement in the Baghdad blast.
Well, I think it is an indication right now that despite the fact that ISIS is currently losing ground to the Iraqi army and to the counter-ISIL coalition, we still have the problem of ISIS, the terrorist organization, that even though the organization may now be losing ground and its government may even be collapsing, the very ideology of ISIS will continue, and we should expect there to be a phase two of this conflict, even if the caliphate falls.
How is it that the Islamic State's ideology can keep fueling terrorism when the group is losing territory?
Well, I mean, the ideology has been one that has been around for quite some time. You know, obviously we saw it on 9/11. It's existed before that in other forms. You know, there's a debate in Washington and around the world right now about exactly what to call it, whether it's militant Islam or radical Islam or jihadism. The fact remains is that this is an ideology with staying power, and ISIS is only the most recent incarnation of this ideology, and so we should expect it to continue to live on regardless of what happens to the caliphate.
Well, the attack in Baghdad seems to be part of a series of attacks either claimed by or inspired by the Islamic State around the world in recent weeks. How much of those attacks do you see as being a coincidence, or how deliberate do you think they might be?
Well, my sense is that we are currently witnessing a campaign to mark the month of Ramadan. This is something that we saw during the Iraq conflict after U.S. forces took the country. And I think that we're going to continue to see attacks probably for the next day or two. I think there's a lot of heightened fear here in the United States after the CIA director announced that the United States could potentially be a target. So we'll wait until the end of Ramadan, which is on Wednesday, and hope that we see no more attacks around the world, and certainly not here in the United States.
What do you think the United States and its partners can do to try to prevent more of these attacks, you know, inspired by this ideology that you say just doesn't go away?
Well, certainly I think one element of this is about defeating the caliphate itself. The more ISIS looks like a losing bet, perhaps this could be a way to roll back those who might embrace the ideology. That will not work by itself. There needs to be a broader strategy that tries to weaken this ideology worldwide. This would certainly entail working with our Sunni partners in the Gulf and around the Arab world to work in the mosques and to work at an education level, a grassroots level, to try to diminish the appeal of this ideology. I think there is one other element that can't be overlooked, and that is that that a lot of the ISIS supporters, certainly in Syria and Iraq, are fighting against a stronger Iran. They're fearful that the United States has empowered Iran and therefore believe that they are engaged in a sectarian battle, a holy war against the Iranian-backed coalition that would include Hezbollah, it would include the Assad regime, and also IRGC and Iranian forces on the ground. As long as this sectarian conflict rages. It will be very, very difficult to roll back the forces of this Sunni jihadist trend. And so this will also be part of the equation for the United States.
Well, thank you very much to Jonathan Schanzer, Vice President for Research at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, for speaking to International Edition.
Thank you.
Well, it's time now for a look at social media, and I'm joined in the studio by Andrew Polchevsky. Hey, Andrew, what's going on?
Hey, Michael. Well, it's a lot of attention about this attack in Iraq, especially with the Turkish attack that happened just last week. People wondering if this is going to be happening all throughout the summer, if we're going to continue seeing these kinds of attacks. So there's a lot of concern, a lot of fear on social media. Switching gears, Brexit. Of course, that Brexit vote happened a couple weeks ago. Still the talk of social media today because Nigel Farage, the UKIP party leader, has announced his resignation.
Yeah, he says, and he was one of the leaders of the campaign for Britain to leave the European Union, right?
Yeah, so now somebody tweeted out and said all of the major figures, or at least most of them, between David Cameron, Boris Johnson, the former London mayor, and now Nigel Farage, have all announced their resignations. Nigel Farage saying, you know, I want to resign, I want my life back. And somebody tweeted out him, said to him, you want your life back? Well, I want my future back. So a lot of people striking out against him even after the vote, saying that all of the people who helped to get this vote going between Cameron, Johnson, and Farage have all kind of fled. But
yeah.
The leave people, the Brexit people, saying, well, we just need to change leadership. It's just a natural evolution. So they're trying to say that this isn't anything out of the norm. But
right. And Britain is still going to leave at some point.
Apparently. And yeah, there's still a lot of questions about that on social media. But in happier news for us, 240 years ago today, the United States declared our leaving the
yeah,
UK and Britain. And so
our own version of Brexit.
Our own version of Brexit, yes. So it's 4th of July, Independence Day here in the US. On social media, we're seeing a lot of impressive displays of red, white, and blue clothing. So this really cool blazer that was blue with white stars and then red pants and a red and white striped tie. So people decked out in all their red, white, and blue finest. A lot of excitement for barbecues coming up later today. And then people sharing famous versions of the national anthem, a lot of iconic American imagery, a lot of bald eagles, Whitney Houston singing the national anthem, all good stuff. And fireworks, of course, photos of fireworks, which we're going to see all into the evening tonight.
That's right, and there are fireworks scheduled for here in Washington tonight, but it could rain. They could be rained out, which is quite unusual, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, and that's a lot of social media here in the D.C. area, people wondering, is it going to rain? Is it going to hold off? Will we get fireworks?
Fingers so crossed that it happens either tonight or tomorrow.
Yes, hopefully.
Thanks so much. You can follow Andrew on Twitter at APAL, and I'm at Michael_Lippin. This is VOA. New York's Jewish community has held a private funeral service for the late Holocaust survivor and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel, who died Saturday at the age of 87. Wiesel was born in Romania and became a U.S. citizen in 1956. He was known as one of the world's leading commentators about Nazi Germany's Holocaust against the Jews and other minority groups. Wiesel visited Israel often and was remembered by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu as one of the spiritual giants of the Jewish people. Joseph Olmert is a political science professor at the University of South Carolina. Olmert met Wiesel while serving as the head of Israel's press office in the 1990s and spoke to VOA about what he sees as Wiesel's legacy.
He was a great man because he was a combination of many things. First of all, he was a great writer, you know. And secondly, of course, he was a man of conscience, you know. I think President Obama was right on the spot, you know, defining him as the conscience of the world, you know. And he was also very, very proud of his Jewish heritage and very, very supportive of the State of Israel. That should not be, you know, overlooked as well. So he combined in his personality many occupations, and managed to the last day of his life to remain a voice of conscience that was really adhered to and revered and listened to by millions of people, not just by Jews.
Well, soon after winning the Nobel Peace Prize in 1986, Wiesel and his wife founded the Elie Wiesel Foundation for Humanity to combat indifference, intolerance, and injustice. Here are some of the top stories right now on the VOA website. U.S. Democrats express confidence that their presumptive presidential nominee, Hillary Clinton, won't be indicted over her email scandal. Members of Britain's Labour Party fear it is heading for disaster after the country's vote in favour of Brexit or leaving the European Union. South Korea to build artificial reefs in Yellow Sea. Israel's Netanyahu starts a rare Africa trip. And a suicide bomber attacks near a U.S. consulate in Saudi Arabia. Expanded coverage of these stories and more is on voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. China says it will hold a week's worth of military exercises beginning Tuesday in the South China Sea's disputed waters. The exercises are due to end a day before a UN Court of Arbitration is expected to rule on July 12th in a Philippine case challenging the validity of Beijing's vast territorial claims in the South China Sea. Malcolm Cook is a senior fellow at the Singapore-based Institute for Southeast Asian Studies. My colleague Victor Beatty asked him how the Philippines' newly inaugurated president, Rodrigo Duterte, is likely to handle the maritime dispute with China.
During the campaign for the president and after, there's been some conflicting messages where at one point in the campaign he criticized the decision of the Aquino government to take China to the arbitration tribunal, noting, as has been the Chinese position, that China will not respect whatever the ruling is. But after some criticism, he and his team have clarified that they will support or uphold the ruling of the tribunal and use that as the basis for their negotiation. So it's becoming clearer how the new president will address the situation, and that makes it less likely that that will be able to restart effective bilateral talks with China.
Well, media reports indicate China is preparing to hold seven-day military drills around disputed islands beginning Tuesday. What do you make of that? Is that a signal?
Certainly is a signal. The fact that the operations, as reported so far, are going to take place in the Paracel Islands that are far away from the Philippines suggests that they're not targeting the Philippines, but are more a general expression of Chinese force and commitment to their claims in the South China Sea. The fact that they've said that ships will be blocked from the military area during the military exercises reasserts that the Chinese see these waters as their exclusive waters and not as high seas or international waters or waters in dispute with Vietnam in this case.
Do you anticipate that China's neighbors will just simply acquiesce to Chinese hegemony over the South China Sea?
It certainly seems that since 2008 or 2010, China has shifted from what used to be called a charm offensive to becoming much more aggressive in these disputed waters. So far, Southeast Asian states have pushed back diplomatically with increasing cooperation amongst at least the maritime Southeast Asian states. But I think all realize that there's no way that they can do anything more than increase the diplomatic costs on China. Costs many think China will be willing to accept in return for gaining a much higher level of sea control. So I think many Southeast Asian states, including the new administration in the Philippines, have a rather dour view of these disputes and China's interests going forward.
And that was Malcolm Cook of the Institute for Southeast Asian Studies speaking with International Edition's Victor Beatty. This 4th of July, U.S. space agency NASA's solar-powered Juno spacecraft will arrive at Jupiter after an almost five-year journey. International Edition's Laurie London spoke with Greg Redfern of NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab Solar System about what the exploration will entail and what it could reveal about the largest planet in our solar system.
This is called Juno to the planet Jupiter. And Jupiter is the largest planet in the solar system. It's known as the king of the planets. So Juno is going to be arriving at Jupiter on the nation's birthday to begin a wonderful 20 months of exploration The king of the planets, up close and personal.
And what will it be doing? Will it be taking pictures? I assume it's not going to be able to land on there.
Well, you're right. It's not going to land. It's going to orbit. And it's going to have a special orbit, Lori, that takes us over the north and south pole of Jupiter for the first time in our exploration of the planet poles. And it will get to within 3,100 miles at its closest approach during this orbit to give us an unprecedented view with the Juno Cam, a camera designed to return pictures, as well as the scientific instruments. This whole mission is designed to finally answer some questions about what is Jupiter made of, what's in the cloud tops, is there water, what's the gravity field of this giant planet like? What's the magnetic field? And we're really going to rewrite the textbooks on Jupiter.
What do we stand to gain from understanding more about this planet?
In learning more about Jupiter, we're going to learn more about our solar system. Why do we have four rocky planets that we call the terrestrial planets? That's Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars. And why do we have four giant gas giant planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune? We're going to learn about how our solar system forms, how do planets form, and we're going to find out how the biggest planet in the whole solar system is comprised, what it's made of, how it came about, and that helps in our knowledge of how we, planet Earth, came into existence and evolved.
If all goes as planned, what can we expect and when?
The spacecraft on autopilot on July 4th is supposed to begin pre-Jupiter orbit insertion operations. And what that essentially means is the spacecraft is going to prepare itself to align to fire its main engine for 35 minutes starting at about 11:16 p.m., Eastern Daylight Time, July 4th. And what our listeners have to realize, Jupiter is 534 million miles away, which means it takes radio signals traveling at the speed of light, and that's 186,000 miles a second. And
wow,
as fast as that is, it still takes us 48 minutes one way from Jupiter to our radio antennas to collect those signals. And if all goes well, it will enter into an orbit around Jupiter, being captured by the giant gravity well of Jupiter.
And that was Greg Redfern of NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab Solar System in conversation with my colleague Lori London. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
The European Space Agency says its comet-chasing Rosetta orbiter will wrap up its mission on September 30th. That's when the space agency will send the spacecraft on a controlled descent to the surface of its comet 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko. ESA says the mission has to end because the spacecraft and the comet it's chasing are traveling too far from the sun, which is reducing the solar power needed to operate Rosetta and its instruments. Adding to the decision to terminate the mission is the plain fact that the spacecraft is pretty much getting near the end of its life, having to deal with the harsh environment of space for over 12 years, two of which was spent close to the dusty comet. As it drops to the surface of 67P during the final hours of its mission, Rosetta will capture some close-up images and make a number of what ESA calls once-in-a-lifetime measurements of the comet. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. As the United States celebrates its 240th birthday, some people would rather go to a movie than follow the crowds of thousands who flock to see the traditional fireworks. Here's my colleague Lori London again, this time speaking with Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard about what he thinks moviegoers should see.
We have some big movies. 4th of July is a big platform for some large films. One that I have been looking forward to, because I've been a fan my whole life, is The Legend of Tarzan. And the first thing people say to me is, do we really need a $140 million remake of Tarzan in 2016? I'm like, why not?
Is it worth it? You saw it, right?
I did. So going into Tarzan, I thought, okay, here we go. We're going to see the origin of Tarzan all over again, like we've seen 1,000 times. It doesn't do that. It starts already with Tarzan being a nobleman in England, married to Jane. So I thought, wow, okay, good. The first hour of this movie, we don't have to rehash and tell me an interesting story. So he travels back to the Congo on behalf of the King of Belgium, who wants these diamonds to finance his army and his empire. And he's tagging along with him as Samuel Jackson, playing George Washington Williams, who's a real man who actually went with the Lord of Greystoke back to the Congo. So we have action-adventure. We have, you know, him swinging through the vines, and we have some really great performances. I enjoyed it immensely. I mean, I was really surprised how exciting it was. And Alan Skarsgård playing Tarzan was brilliant. Samuel Jackson gave great comic relief. But the problem is, do people want to see Tarzan, a big-budget Tarzan, in this day and age, especially during the summer? So I'm not sure what the audience is going to be, but I think the older crowd will really enjoy it.
I think it looks really good. I definitely am planning on seeing it.
It's a great escape. Yeah. It really is. It's an old-fashioned, big-budget epic, which I really enjoyed because, you know, I love the Victorian era. So it's so rich in detail. And also director David Yates, who directed 3 or 4 of the Harry Potter films, really knows how to handle a big-budget epic. And that's what I really enjoyed about the location. It's really good to see an old-fashioned, majestic epic.
Awesome. And what about The Purge election year? How's that?
Well, if you're looking for a thriller, this is the third one in the series. And if you're not familiar with The Purge, the premise is simple. Murder and mayhem, and there's no law. One night a year where people go out and get revenge on their boss. They can do all the rights they feel, you know, by murder is legal. So it's really a crazy concept, but it's a very successful film series. And this is the third one called Election Year, where the powers that be want to keep the purge. They're all for it. And there's also these candidates that are running against it, saying, look, the purge is barbaric. We need to end it. So it turns into a battle of politicians and a battle of parties trying to kill one another so they can keep their agenda. So I think it's straight from the formula. I love the first two purges, especially the original one. It's really a unique kind of a sci-fi futuristic concept. But this one, they kind of strayed from the formula and just made it really political, which I think really deterred from the movie. But it only cost $10 million to make, so it's going to make a fortune. I think it already was targeted to make $40 million its opening weekend. So The Purge is alive and well.
And that was Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard with Laurie London. You can find more movie reviews like those on the web at vegasfilmcritic.com. Well, that's it for International Edition on The Voice of America. Your director today was Patrice Martin, and the engineer was Keith Holmes. You can find our show on Twitter at VOA_IE. I'm also there at Michael_Lippin. Well, thank you for joining us today, and for all those celebrating, happy Independence Day from the U.S. Capitol.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
Self-government, that is, a people exercising all the necessary functions of power without interference by a higher authority that they can't control themselves, is a core American value. It's also at the heart of the Declaration of Independence, which we celebrate today. Thomas Jefferson, the document's primary author, wrote that self-rule is the separate and equal station that a people are entitled to under the laws of God and nature. It didn't come easily. America's early history is marked by conflict with other countries threatened by Republican government and among Americans themselves over the ultimate form that that government would take. But the Declaration laid the framework for a nation that would endure and grow, inspiring similar independence movements around the world. When war first broke out between Britain and its North American colonists, few imagined, let alone supported, the creation of a new nation. Historians note that even as the fighting raged, the colonists were deeply divided over the future. Roughly a third came to believe a complete break with Britain was needed. A third remained loyal to the British crown, and a third simply wanted to be left alone to raise their families and do their jobs. The 56 men who signed the Declaration on July 4, 1776, cast the first votes for independence. Their fellow citizens ratified the choice, and with it the then radical principle that government should be based on the consent of the governed. While this is the event and cause we celebrate today, it isn't unique to Americans. It is embodied in the constitutions of many nations and observed in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that we all recognize. In essence, then, Independence Day is a celebration of our common humanity.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.